From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, February the 20th, 2020. 2220. I don't know if there's some kind of synergy to that date or anything, but we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be talking in the first hour here about Act 250 and proposed changes that have been making their way through a special commission that studied that 50-year-old land use law and then suggested some legislation. And legislature has been working on, particularly the House Natural Resources Committee, has been working on these proposed changes all of last session and into this session now. And a big wrinkle came up in January when the Scott administration and the Vermont Natural Resources Council announced that they were going to be reached a compromise on proposed legislation diminishing the role of the regional commissions that have been sort of the linchpin, the first stop on Act 250 for all of its 50 years, really. And go to a more streamlined statewide process that some people have analogized to, say, the Public Utility Commission. And we are going to be hearing in the first part of the show this morning from Ed Stanek, who's a retired Act 250 district coordinator. He worked in District 5 based in Barrie for 31 years. Initially, he was a roving district coordinator, and then he settled in Barrie and spent the bulk of his career there. A little later this hour, we're going to be hearing from John Grobman of the Vermont Natural Resources, the aforementioned Vermont Natural Resources Council, which has been pushing some of the changes to Act 250. Grobman argues that the law needs to be modernized in a big way, and that in part of the effort to do that, there was this compromise with the Scott administration, which wants to streamline the process. So we'll be talking a lot about Act 250 in the next hour. So later on in the second hour of the program today, we're going to have a conversation with folks from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. It's our regular weekly Thursday feature these days. We call it our Seeds to Society segment. It's all about how food is grown in Vermont and how food is consumed in Vermont and marketed and all the different aspects of where our food comes from and how it gets to us and so on and so forth. And today we are going to be talking about protecting our dairy herds, herd health and biosecurity. The biosecurity seems to be the buzzword among a lot of farmers these days in terms of keeping diseases that could really devastate a dairy herd away and not active here in the state of Vermont. There are some steps farmers need to be thinking about, and we'll be talking about those in our second hour this morning. But first, let's start out with my guest, Ed Stanek. He is in the studio with us this morning. And Ed, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And Ed, you mentioned to me before we started that you had this long career as district coordinator under Act 250. You were kind of a point man taking the applications in when they first came in the door. Is that right?
That's correct. I served as administrative staff for the district commission, the three citizen volunteers appointed by the governor. Mm-hmm. So I worked with the applicants, shaped the applications to ensure an efficient and orderly process once it got to the district commission.
So your District 5 would encompass, I gather, Washington County and what else around?
Washington and Lamoille counties, 35 towns. It includes Stowe, Sugarbush, everything in between.
Wow. And so and retail commercial developments like the Berlin Mall and the and various other projects that have occurred over time.
A lot of mining projects. The glacier left a lot of sand and gravel in Lamoille County, so we did a lot of mining projects too.
And what about the granite quarries in Barrie?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Act 250 really covers a lot of different areas. Anytime you want to do any kind of development that has an impact on the environment in Vermont, you need to at least ask yourself, is Act 250 implicated here? In fact, walk me through that process, the way it has worked over the last 50 years. Let's say I wanted to build a convenience store and gas station on the corner of Routes 1 and 2.
Right.
What do I need to be thinking about vis-a-vis Act 250?
So the two big so-called jurisdictional triggers for Act 250 are commercial and industrial development, and then the other one is subdivision of land. So from the beginning, you know, Act 250 has always been premised on local control. So therefore, if it's a town where there is zoning and subdivision regulations, Act 250 is out of the picture unless the commercial industrial development's on more than 10 acres of land. by default, if the town has no local control, 1 acre triggers commercial industrial development. And then the short explanation for subdivision of land is 10 or more lots triggers Act 250. But you know, it's important to note that in this day and age, only 30% of all development and subdivision going on in Vermont is any longer subject to Act 250. Putting it the other way, 70% of all the development subdivision in Vermont does not have anything to do with Act 250. There's a lot of confusion out there, by golly. If I need a permit, it's an Act 250 permit. It's not true. Only 30%, for better or worse, goes through Act 250 any longer.
And the reason for that, the diminishment of the percentage of projects which go through Act 250, I gather, is that more and more local communities have adopted their own zoning regulations, correct?
That's right. Strengthening of local control, therefore Act 250 backed off on jurisdiction. And the second factor is, over the last few years, the legislature has been increasing the number of exemptions to incentivize or encourage development, quote unquote, in the right places. So they've been backing off jurisdiction, for example, on residential projects. You know, if it's in the right place, you no longer need to go through Act 250.
So if you are in a city, typically, and if you're in Barrie or Montpelier or Stowe or Waterbury, really, you're going to be subject to local zoning and probably not Act 250.
That's correct.
And that's a lot different from the way the world worked back 50 years ago when Act 250 started out, right?
That's right, because Dean Davis and the folks back then had the wisdom and the insight that a lot of the towns had no local control, and they needed to have something. A compelling state interest was to protect the ecosystems and particularly water quality.
The water quality issues in Act 250. Don't extend. I mean, Act 250 has never extended to agriculture in Vermont, for instance, right?
Correct.
So that's another giant sort of track of development or activity in Vermont, which is not under the Act 250 umbrella.
Right. Nothing to do with Act 250.
So I guess Act 250 is maybe considered to be more ubiquitous than it really is.
That's correct. You know, even Phil Scott had a terrible experience with Act 250, he thought, when he was a young businessman. He wanted to open a motorcycle shop. And long story short, he still tells us on the campaign trail that he changed his whole career because of a dastardly delay in Act 250. Well, the public record indicates Phil was finished and done with Act 250 in 32 days as a minor application.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the guy he teamed up with, who owned the property, dragged his feet for months for getting a related Agency of Natural Resources wastewater permit. So there's a perfect example where had nothing to do with Act 250. The delay, by law and rule, the commission had to wait for the ANR wastewater permit.
And so when the governor says that Act 250 is what slowed him down or prevented his project, that's really not the case.
Public record indicates that's not correct.
Wow. And that was, were you the district coordinator back then?
Well, you know, luckily in hindsight, that was the year we took the great family trip to Yellowstone. So somebody else covered the base for me. But again, the public records there, Phil was over and done with Act 250, 32 days.
Wow. Okay. And is that pretty typical? I mean, talk to me also about, people talk about being tied up in Act 250 forever. Is that pretty typical that it's a month or more?
You know, no government process is perfect. I don't think that's a standard for any government agency, including legislative branch.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, Act 250 has always had these performance standards, so many days or weeks within which to get something done. You know, I lived by those performance standards. You could see in these large controversial cases that people would be raising these concerns of or allegations of delay. So every case, long story short, has a procedural history in it, indicating from day one all the way through to the final decision. So, yes, there are some cases which take a long time. A lot of the time we were waiting for additional submittals from an applicant.
Yeah, I just was caught on when you said no government process is perfect. I was thinking to myself, well, there was that phone call to Ukraine. But I joke. I kid around. So Act 250 right now is proposed to get some big changes. What are some of the biggest changes envisioned in the legislation that's currently pending?
The pending bill would basically eliminate any meaningful role for the district commissions, which have been the heart of Act 250 for 50 years. The proposed bill also has some language in it which is feel-good language, you know, in terms of forest blocks and habitat. But for a lot of reasons, it doesn't really have a punch behind it. This is very unfortunate because, as we were discussing a little bit, this goes back to a legislative study committee that went across the state for 2 years gathering public input. They gave a report in December 2018, which the House Natural Resources Committee picked up with in January of last year, and worked all of last year quite diligently in a methodical way to come up with a good bill. When they left off in May, everyone thought they'd come back this year, and by mid-January, the bill would be going to the floor of the House. That did not happen.
And the reason that that got sort of waylaid or whatever is what?
On January 7th, a private organization, VNRC, and the Scott administration produced a 74-page basically counter-proposal, which sort of disregarded the work that was done by the Legislative Study Committee and the House Natural Resources Committee. And this proposal first began with the total elimination of the district commissions, and then it went on to add some other components. In my opinion, that was poison down the well, and quite frankly, it was a hijacking of the process by the House Natural Resources Committee. Up until that point, all of us, everyone proceeded in good faith with that process.
My impression is that the committee chair has been cool to this idea of significantly reducing the role of the district commissions or eliminating them or whatever.
Well, what happened was after the original VNRC Scott proposal to eliminate the commissions ran into, to say the least, trouble, suddenly that morphed into, well, we'll keep the district commissions to do minors, but we're still going to create this new board at a cost of $640,000 to do the hearings that the district commissions did quite well for 50 years.
And the new board, again, would be a statewide board of what?
It would be mirroring the Public Utility Commission, formerly known as the Public Service Board. Mm-hmm. So they would be paying, I think the estimated salary is something like, plus benefits, $140,000 for each of these three professional members on the board. By the way, district commission members now do the same work for $100 a day.
And that is a significant difference. I think the other thing about that, you know, you hear about the complaints directed toward the former Public Service Board, now Public Utility Commission, that it's too litigious, it's too much like a court, it's too inaccessible for average citizens to have input into its processes. I would gather that you must be worried that a similar fate would befall any new board built along the same lines.
That's correct. You know, I have been to Public Service Board, now Public Utility Commission hearings. And I've actually seen, you know, as an experienced bureaucrat myself, you can see how hyper-legalistic it is. And I contrast that with what the former Environmental Board used to do. This is the board that was eliminated in 2004 under that wave of quote-unquote permit reform. The Environmental Board was still user-friendly. They took the appeals of the district commissions, and they knew their role was to cross T's, dot I's on legal procedure and stuff, but it was still an opportunity for the salt of the earth to be on equal footing with the biggest developers. And that was eliminated. When the board was eliminated, it was now Environmental Court, which mm-hmm. is also a hyperlistic. So part of the Legislative Study Committee report identified the problem with the appeals, and that's where the House Natural Resources Committee was going in 2019, and now we wound up with this proposal for this professional board, which will be just like the PUC.
The Act 250 law has been actually praised. I've seen national media reports about it over time in terms of its welcoming citizen involvement, especially at the district commission level. Is that the main problem you see here? Is that that's going to be diminished?
Well, two problems. One is certainly that would be a major blow to Act 250. If this prevails, there'll be some sort of land use control law in Vermont, but they should not call it Act 250 anymore. It will be a new undertaking. But the other thing, too, that's unfortunate is the lost opportunity now in this law to really address 21st century challenges. That fell by the wayside. And we could talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, the profound implications of climate change in Vermont.
I thought there were some climate change provisions still in the bill, aren't there?
There are. The criteria.
The criteria would expand to include impacts on climate.
That's right. But my point is that we know that there's a reasonable expectation of climate migration into Vermont. And there's a reasonable expectation that the first wave will be people with wealth that will be wanting to relocate from places which are seeing the dire effects of climate change now, like California and Florida, for example. And so there is nothing in this bill that prepares for that. And this is the wisdom that they had back in the late 1960s, Dean Davis in the crowd. But there's no comparable provision in this bill now. For example, everything about 1,500 feet in Vermont, the aquifer recharge areas, water quality, the watersheds of the rivers, the last remaining intact forest, the habitat areas. But there's nothing in the law right now that anticipates these new growth changes in the 21st century. Again, unfortunately, everything was waylaid by this battle now over district commissions and the bill in the current form.
And so... would there be a way to maybe do this a little more piecemeal, pass the changes to respond to the climate change issue right now and then save the battle over the district commissions for another time or something like that?
In fact, there is discussion on that very topic going on in the State House.
To sort of bifurcate or break in half this
correct
this whole project to rewrite Act 250. What are some of the other things? I mean, there are clearly some baby in this bathwater, I would think, and the climate changes would be among them. Anything else you'd like to see proceed and be saved?
Well, you know, there are two new jurisdictional provisions. One deals with interchange areas on the interstates. Nothing mm-hmm. wrong with that, but it just mm-hmm. covers within 2,000 feet of the interchanges. And another new jurisdictional provision deals with subdivision of land where a combination of common road and driveways, if it all adds up to more than 2,000 feet, that'll come under Act 250. Well, that sounds good, but you know, we used to have the old road rule, 800 feet. You know what we saw? We saw a lot of site plans with 799-foot roads to avoid jurisdiction. And you know what's going to happen with these 2,000-foot road provision? 1,999-foot road subdivisions to avoid jurisdiction. So it sounds good. It feels good. Doesn't really signify much.
Talk to me a little more about the interchange rule here or proposed. There's been a lot of discussion, especially around Exit 4 in Randolph.
Correct.
And what's going to be built there and what land is going to be protected and so on and so forth. And I'm just wondering if do you have any sense that there is a how would these changes apply to an area like that?
Well, I kind of go back to the late 1960s with the so-called billboard law. And I mention that because in Title 10 VSA, I think it's Chapter 45, there's a lot more besides the billboard law. The legislature made findings of fact in 1969 that the importance of these scenic corridors on the interstate are critical to the economic aspects of Vermont. Mm-hmm. That's why these scenic corridors have been jealously protected for the last 50 years. So we get now to the interchanges, and this goes back kind of in a way to Howard Dean, where he had concern about, you know, development beginning to sprawl at those interchanges, such as we've seen in Chittenden County. And, you know, he put a finger in the dike with an executive order. Subsequent governors just dissolved the executive order. So this bill now is an attempt to get hands around what you can see at those interchanges.
Let's bring in a listener. I believe Susanna is on the line from Walden. Good morning, Susanna.
Hi. I have two questions, actually, for Ed. One, I'm wondering if ridgelines are protected in this proposed bill. And two, one of the complaints about the existing Act 250 process is that the appeals to the Environmental Court are de novo. And the complaint is that it gives the public two bites of the apple. And I'd like Ed to explain that. Thanks.
So ridgelines first. There's nothing in the bill in its final form that deals with ridgelines. There was a provision in the VNRC Scott proposal that dealt with ridgelines about 1,500 feet, but 400 wide swaths along the top of the ridgeline. And in the earlier iteration of the House Natural Resources Bill, there was a lot of other language about ridgelines, but all that has fallen by the wayside. So there's currently nothing in the bill about ridgelines. And with respect to the appeals being de novo, there's really a misunderstanding out there. It's not a completely blank slate. The developer doesn't start at ground zero. The only thing that is covered on the appeal are the one or two criteria, which is an appeal. So it's not the whole case all over again. The district commission process, you know, people come what is this thing all about? The neighbor next door is trying to participate, learn the process at the same time. You know, it's too simplistic to say district commissions are the dry run, but it isn't true that people hide in the bushes just waiting for appeals to strangle development. The advantage to having a district commission process right now is people get up the learning curve so that if there is an appeal to the environmental court, usually brought by the developer, then the salt of the earth have an opportunity to decide if it's worth now anteing up money to hire a lawyer. You know, in other words, the issues are defined initially on the district commission level, and then if you want to go to the appeal process, then...
So, I mean, I think that's a key distinction that probably needs to be hammered home and clarified in my own mind, and maybe that of some listeners, which is that if you're talking about an appeal on Act 250, let's say the contentious criterion has to do with traffic counts or
yes,
whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, and there's a disagreement. The district commission makes a certain finding relating to traffic counts and how they're going to be handled by the existing road network, or whether the road network near the project needs to be expanded, et cetera, et cetera. And that's going to go on appeal to the environmental court. The rest of the case does not come up for appeal. Is that right?
That's correct.
So it would be almost as if somebody were charged with six crimes and went to the criminal court and when was convicted of all six crimes and wanted to appeal one of them. The other crimes or the other verdicts would not be challenged, right?
I guess I agree. I don't know about that analogy, but yeah, that's true. That's I agree with the gist of it.
Yeah, I mean, the idea being that we are narrowing down on on the list of stuff to be considered at the appeal level,
you
considerably.
Know, some of us suggested to the House Natural Resources Committee a user-friendly approach to solve this problem with appeals, and that is a hybrid on the record. So in other words, the district commission decision itself should be given deference by the environmental court. Instead of starting at ground zero, give mm-hmm. weight to that district commission decision and its exhibits and build on that in the environmental court instead of a blank slate. That would reduce the expenses. It would speed it up. This fell on deaf ears because, as I said, come January 7th, everything blew up in that committee.
Ed, it would be good if possible. Can you stick around for a little bit? John Grobman from VNRC is going to be joining us in the second half hour, but it might be good to bounce some stuff back and forth between you if that's okay.
That's fine.
All right. We are going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And we'll get a couple words from our sponsors. And when we return, we're going to keep Ed Stanek on standby here anyway, and then bring in John Grobman from the Vermont Natural Resources Council and get his thoughts on all of this. We'll be back, folks. Stay with us.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We're back, and my guest here in the studio is Ed Stanek. He is the retired Act 250 coordinator for District 5 based in Barrie. And the other guest we're bringing in on the telephone, I believe, is John Grobman of the Vermont Natural Resources Council. And, John, are you there on the phone?
I am, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us this morning. I gather you are probably standing in a statehouse hallway outside of the House, the House Natural Resources Committee, right?
No, but I ran back to my office. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
My cell phone's not working this morning, but
not
interesting for your listeners. But
okay, a little quieter in your office, so that's
it's a better place.
Yep. And how's it been going so far over at the House Ways and Means Committee?
I think they're just kind of, you know, this is the second time they're just hearing about the bill, so I think they're just learning about the bill and trying to understand their focus on the financial impacts of the bill.
And the big one there is, I understand, the creation of a new state board with a budget of at least, $640,000 a year, is that right?
That I think that's the estimate that came out of the House. Yeah, I think it's a range. I think that the committee needs to drill into that and understand, you know, what are the resources that are going to be needed. We certainly, VNRC believes that this is going to work. It needs to be properly resourced. We need to, you know, get it right. And so I think, you know, that's the job of the Ways and Means Committee, to understand the workload that we're asking the board to do and what resources does it need.
And the this board we're talking about now would be, is there a name given to it yet?
I believe the bill calls it the Enhanced Natural Resources Board.
Enhanced Natural Resources Board.
It's not a terrific name. But,
Well, we have an Enhanced 911 Board, so right. maybe we're just enhancing everything in government these days.
The ENRB, I think it's being referred to.
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know. I think there maybe have to be a little bit of head-scratching and skull work on that one.
Yeah, I'm not a marketing expert.
Yeah, I hear you. So Ed Stanek and I have been talking for the first part of the show here this morning about Act 250, and Ed, of course, is skeptical about some of the changes proposed, particularly the diminished role of his former bailiwick, the district commissions here in Vermont. And when somebody comes to you, John Grobman of VNRC, and says, you know, your compromise with the governor appears to diminish the ability of citizens to participate at this district level. How do you placate their concerns?
Well, hopefully it's not placating. It's, you know, saying here's how we think that they're addressed. And so, you know, first I'd just like to start out by saying, I mean, I acknowledge that concern. I think is something we want to make sure we create. So VNRC's goal is not to create a system that is not fair to citizens or citizens can't interact with. And I've read some of the things that Ed has written about it. And, you know, we have a disagreement in terms of what the impact of this bill is going to be. You know, I have a lot of respect for Ed and his work in Act 250, but, you know, I'd hope that people can see that reasonable people can differ. And so here's how we differ. So, and I don't know what you talked about because I was testifying, but
yeah.
I don't know what Ed said, but, you know, under the bill, so, you know, statistically, historically, Act 250 projects break down into minors and majors. I don't know if Ed went through this or not. And, you know, minor projects are basically projects that don't get a hearing, and they don't get a hearing because they're, you know, deemed to be, you know, when the application is filed, not to have significant impacts, or there's not significant interest. And so those go through without a hearing. They're issued by the district commission. You know, there's a back and forth between the district coordinator, the staff person for the commission, and the applicant. And sometimes the public could comment and say they're concerned about this or that. And a condition could be placed in the permit. So it's 80% of the permits. And so under the bill, in our view, that doesn't change, right? So district commissions remain in place, and they will process those minor permits just the way that they do now. I know Ed has said that he thinks that is not meaningful, and I don't see how continuing to process 80% of the projects at the district level is not meaningful. I think.
Well, give me an example, yeah. John, of a project which would be considered minor and be able to go through this type of process.
I mean, like I said, it's 80%. So most projects, most of the things that go through,
okay,
are don't get a hearing. You know, it could be. I mean, I've seen, like, so just so people know. I mean, I've been on your show before, but, you know, I've been a government attorney dealing with Act 250. I was the chair of the Natural Resources Board. I mean, you could see an amendment to an existing project, right?
Yeah.
That is minor. You could see a new project. Maybe it's it has, you know, like in Chittenden County, like a new gas station convenience store on Williston Road could be a minor, right? Because it doesn't, you know, there's a lot of that type of development there, right? So, you know, even though, but a gas station convenience store in, you know, Greensboro, that could be major, right?
Yeah,
because, you know, of the community and the impacts. And people need to keep in mind that Act 250, there's only a jurisdiction over the larger projects in Vermont. So right now, for commercial projects, for example, if your town has zoning and subdivision regulations, it has to be over 10 acres to basically trigger Act 250. But if you don't have zoning and subdivision, it could be 1 acre. So let's just say, for example, Greensboro doesn't have zoning and subdivision. And I don't know that that's true. I'm just for hypothetical sake.
Yeah.
But, you know, rural towns like that often don't have zoning and subdivision regulations. So the small gas station convenience store would trigger Act 250 there. It probably wouldn't even trigger it in larger communities. But so, you know, the point I'm trying to make is it depends on where the project is. And, you know, but most of them go through as these projects without a hearing. And that doesn't change under the system created in the bill. What does change is for the major projects, which are defined as projects that where there's a hearing, the hearing right now is held by a district commission in the, you know, region in the town where the project is located, and it's reviewed solely by the district commission, staffed by the district coordinator. They could get advice from the state natural resources board, but it's up to them, you know, but it's, so it's really there and totally in control of the process. So the significant change is that these major projects would be reviewed by this enhanced natural resources board, which would have 3 professional board members, and the 2 district commissioners would join them and review the project. And the hearing would still be held in the town where the project is located. But there is it's not solely in the authority of the commissions anymore to review those projects. They have, and so this is maybe where there's a disagreement. We think it's still a significant say for the 2 commissioners to, you know, be part of the decision-making process. I've heard in the State House people say things like, well, the commissioners will always be outvoted because there's only 2 of them, and there's 3 board members, but the bill does not require, like, the commissioners and the board to vote in a block. You know, these are human beings. Their charge is actually to make decisions based on the facts and the law, and I don't know how people will vote, right? It could be 1 commissioner and 3 board members or any combination, you know. So but I think one concern is that the commission's power is not the same, right? They don't have the sole authority anymore. They'll now be part of this board. So the citizen participation issue, I think, is a legitimate concern and one that we've been trying to address in the bill. You know, we don't want to create a process at this common, this hybrid board of district commissioners and professional board members, that is not accessible to citizens. That's not the intent of this. There's language in the bill that indicates the intent is for the board to help facilitate citizen participation in the process. I agree that that language needs to be made meaningful and come to light, and it's incumbent upon, as the bill moves through the process, is there improvements to that language that could be made? If this ever comes to fruition, I think everybody who cares about these issues needs to, you know, the board will create rules and, you know, guidelines on how it's going to function and implement the legislative intent, and that needs to be bird dog. So I do think that it will be a more, you know, for the bigger applications, it'll be a formal process because it'll be hearings before the board, and they'll have to create a record, and then the appeal from that decision will go, you know, to the Supreme Court to be reviewed. But our hope is that, you know, for majors that maybe aren't as contested, but there's a need for a hearing, there will be flexibility and informality. You know, there could be hearing officers used to, you know, basically try to facilitate disputes between neighbors. And that's the intent, you know. And I do appreciate the concern that Ed and others have raised about that. And I think the difference is we think it could be addressed. We don't think that this could improve Act 250 in terms of bringing more resources to bear, bringing some professional help to the district commissions who basically are volunteers now, doing this work and don't have to meet any specific qualifications.
Well, okay, John, I'm going to interrupt you because I want to bring in a caller, listener out there who's checking in with us on the phone, and that is Annette from Danby. I think I know Annette, and good morning, Annette.
Morning, Dave.
How are you doing?
Doing good.
It sounds like Annette Smith of Vermonters for a Clean Environment.
That's correct.
Okay, so what's on your mind?
Citizen participation. I mean, this change, I'm still waiting to hear someone say something real about what this change means. This idea that, oh, well, they can work it out later. I mean, the Scott administration and BNRC entered into apparently extensive discussions that a lot of people were included from, excluded from, and a lot of interests were excluded from. And it's a little late to be saying, oh, well, we'll iron out the details of citizen participation later. At the district commission right now, residents of a mobile home park with a quarry proposed next to them can show up at the district commission. They don't have to file any paperwork. They can get party status. They can participate in the hearing. They can be heard. The decisions include comments and, you know, based on their comments. This new proposal, the alleged council staffer told Judiciary yesterday, was modeled on the PUC. And I've spent 10 years helping people participate at the PUC. Dave, you will probably recall I was brought up on criminal investigation for helping people do that.
You were, I believe, under investigation for a while for acting as a lawyer without a license.
Right, for helping people participate in the regulatory process.
Yep.
And now they're creating the same process, and what it will mean is people will have to fill out forms, they'll have to file paperwork, they'll have to do all kinds of things that the average Vermonter does not have time for, and this whole idea is being sort of suppressed as, oh, well, we'll just deal with that later. Sorry, right now, we have a system that's accessible to the average Vermonter. It's efficient. It gets their voices heard. And this new process is basically a gift for rich people and their lawyers.
John Grobman, is this a gift for rich people and their lawyers?
I don't agree with Annette. And I don't, and we're not saying, well, let's just work it out later. As I said, you know, there's language in the bill that directs the board to facilitate citizen participation. I agree. It could be stronger. I agree. We need to do whatever we can to make sure that that intent is effectuated. This is not, is modeled on, I don't know what the Legislative Council said, but I guess it's modeled on the PUC to the extent that it is a professional board. We don't have too many professional boards in the state, but it has really different jurisdiction than the PUC. PUC, complicated jurisdiction having to do with energy system reliability and rates, as well as now siting projects. You know, this will be the Act 250 criteria. The commissioners will be part of the process. I just don't, it's not designed to be the PUC, and that is not the intent. But as I said, I think the concerns that Annette and others are raising are legitimate concerns. And
they're not just concerns. They were issues that we brought to the committee that everybody who testified to that community, including district coordinators, district commissioners, who said, don't do this, lawyers, very few lawyers, we were all ignored. This process was baked and was put into play without any input from the stakeholders, and it got out of committee with nothing in it that recognize the interests of anyone other than VNRC and the Scott administration.
That is completely inaccurate. There, if you look at the record, and go ahead, Dave, and anybody who's listening, just go click on the House committee website. It was a mix. There are people who support the proposal that aren't VNRC. There are people who oppose it and are raising legitimate concerns about the proposal.
No, we wanted to be a part of it. This bill could have been a good bill had there been a legitimate process, had we not all been blindsided on the first day of the session.
Let me bring Ed Stanek back into the discussion here. Ed,
you've been one thing, David, that the process isn't over, and it's just beginning, and I don't know where this bill is going to end up or how it's going to end up. And, you know, so, I mean, the process is we're in the middle of the process, and people are appropriately expressing their opinions about the bill and the concerns, and I think that's what's happening. So, I mean, it's good you're having the show. It's good that people are commenting. I just think that the record doesn't reflect that. Like, no one else supports this proposal. I agree that there's a mix, and some people very much oppose it, and there are people who support it, and we're trying to work through these issues. I mean, that's what we're trying to do.
I didn't say no one else supported it. I said that everybody else's input was not included.
That's what I heard you saying. And if I
in
heard
the
you
final
wrong,
bill, there is no recognition of anybody's input other than what was presented by the Scott administration. This is politics. This is not good legislative
process. I don't think
process.
That's accurate either, because there were significant changes to the bill that were made that did not reflect the, you know, the proposal that was submitted. There were provisions that were taken out that were significantly altered. The committee clearly made its
decision.
They
didn't add in things that could have been added to enhance the bill.
Okay, I get the back and forth. I mean, basically, Annette, you feel like you were cut out of the process in developing the proposal
people.
That
yeah.
landed on January 7th of this year. And let me bring Ed Stanek back into the discussion here because maybe he can provide somewhat of a in-between point of view or something here. But Ed, how did you see that? Did you think that there was insufficient input from others into the process at this point? Point given this fairly heavyweight proposal from both VNRC and the Scott administration that got dropped at the beginning of January?
Well, to the credit of the House Natural Resources Committee, it turned into never-ending streams of testimony and submittals. So if you put it on the bathroom scale, everybody had an opportunity to have a lot to say. But
it's not out of committee yet, is it?
It is out of committee. House Natural Resources Committee passed it out last Thursday.
Oh, I'm sorry. And it's now in Ways and Means, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Ways and Means has quote-unquote possession of it, but just for a revenue stream.
Okay. And that's interesting there, too, because did it stop at appropriations first? Or
Not yet.
Not yet.
Maybe
okay.
never.
That's my point. It has a long way to go. I mean, that's the point. I mean, and, you know, it's not, the process is, then it's not even on the House floor. And who knows when it gets to the House floor and when what the bill says.
And then what do you know about where the Senate's coming from on this?
I've heard that the Senate is very unhappy that it's taken the House so long to get a bill over, that this is basically a two-year process, and that I think they had hoped that the bill would have passed out last session and they would have this session to do it. And so it's, you know, they're running out of time. They've got the Global Warming Solutions Act coming over to them. They've got a lot of heavy lifting to do on other bills. And this is a big bill with massive changes in it. So I'm not hearing that the Senate has a very good feeling about it.
Well, of course, it could become a sort of a bargaining chip at the end of the session. You never know if the Senate wants the Global Warming Solutions Act, maybe the Senate's going to have to give the House
that's
something.
That's a big concern, and that's why those of us who are feeling shut out of what's happened so far. I mean, if this committee had been able to start where they left off in the last session, I believe they would have had a bill out in a couple of weeks. We would not be in the position we're in right now where we're trying to have to scurry to salvage the best thing about Act 250, which is the district commission process, and build on that.
Yep.
And instead, we're having to really be concerned about this thing just getting rammed through the way it is with a lot of expense to the state that has not been well estimated, and a lot of added expense to the applicants and to the interveners in this new process. This is all about money, and it is a full employment bill for lawyers. Let lawyers write it, and that's what they get.
And then I'm going to let you go because I got to get another caller in here. Let's bring in Forbes from East Corinth. Good morning, Forbes.
I had the pleasure of speaking numerous times with Dean Davis. He owned my home.
Wow.
And Act 250 came about basically from a problem down in Dover and Wilmington.
Mm-hmm.
Where unscrupulous developers would come in and buy a 300-acre farm up and divide it into quarter-acre lots. And the select boards or towns didn't have any zoning. So he put together a 10-point, quite comprehensive guideline, I say. It was never, in his terms, wanting to be legislation, but a good guideline for towns that had no zoning. And what we've, how we've ever come to this situation is way beyond me. We, the little person doesn't stand a chance anymore. But we're moving decision-making away from the legislative body into boards and bureaus that it looks quite lucrative to me. But
by the little person, Forbes, do you mean the person who's trying to build something, or do you mean the person who has concerns about it?
Has to invest $50,000 in permitting for a $10,000 job. It's just taking it completely out of his realm or chance.
Yeah.
I don't like it, and I'm sure a lot of other people don't. but we've come a long ways, baby.
All right. Thanks for the call, Forbes. I appreciate it.
Can I just address a couple of things?
Yeah, sure. Yep.
Before she went. So, number one, you know, I think we did speak to lots of different people about the bill, including the legislators, and we, you know, as we, at the proposal, I should say, and we, all along the way, you know, we queried, you know, whether or not, you know, this would be helpful to them, and it's not, it was never intended to be, you know, it goes into the process, and they take it and do with the proposal what they see fit, and that's what they've done. The bill that's come out is not exactly the proposal, nor would anybody expect it to be, right? I mean, of course it's going to change. And so I think the idea was to facilitate the process. The other point I want to make is that, and I've heard different things about this, but this argument is really perplexing to me, is that there's a lot of other provisions in the bill. And the last time I was on, we talked about this process provision. I'd like to come on next time to talk about the other provisions. We've been fighting for 8 years now to put forest protection criteria into the bill and habitat protection criteria into Act 250 that doesn't exist now. I think they're strong. They're not weak. I don't know how they could be characterized as weak. We are trying to expand jurisdiction for the first time to address these issues. Is it a perfect expansion of jurisdiction? You know, probably not. But you know, it's a way for the first time to try to address development. You hear from the prior caller, there's people on all sides of this debate. There are people who, you know, I gleam from the call, think Act 250 is too, you know, doesn't like Act 250 and the review and the costs and whatever. And we think Act 250 has had tremendous benefits for Vermont, and the environmental provisions that we're putting in, the criteria and jurisdictional changes will strengthen it further. So it's a complicated bill.
Yep.
We think overall will further environmental protection.
More discussion to come on this complicated bill, John Groban. Yeah. I got to go, but I appreciate you joining me this morning. Let's do this again sometime soon and figure out more of the nuts and bolts. Ed Stanek, thank you for coming by this morning, former Act 250 commission coordinator. And we're going to go to a top of the hour break with some CBS News.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Well, we spent the first hour talking about Act 250 and proposed changes to that 50-year-old land use law here in Vermont. And a lot of the second hour, we're going to be talking about farm issues, especially biosecurity and dairy herd health. But I wanted to interplay or something with a little bit of a conversation about last night's Democratic debate. It was quite a rollicking time there on the debate involving six candidates for the Democratic nomination for president. And joining us on the phone, we have one of our CBS News correspondents, Steve Futterman, to talk about what went on in Las Vegas last night. I don't think it's staying in Vegas. What happens in Vegas gets broadcast around the country, in this case, or around the world. Steve Futterman, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Great to be with you.
And so who was the big winner and who was the big loser last night, would you say?
Well, right now, remember, these are comments we sometimes will revise in a week or two when we see the totality of what happened here. But based on the early analysis, I think Bernie Sanders probably was a winner last night. I think Bloomberg was a loser, although not a total loser. But those are the basics right now. I think Joe Biden had a good debate. Does it make any difference now? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth Warren had a good debate. Same thing for her. I think Amy Klobuchar had a tough night. She was she and Pete Buttigieg were going after each other back and forth all night. Buttigieg had a decent night, but that would be my grade for basically all of them.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it sounds like I give a harder grade to Bloomberg than you do. I think the thing was a disaster for him, especially when Elizabeth Warren asked him that question, are you willing to essentially release from non-disclosure agreements all of the women who have sued you over time for harassment or other, you know, misbehavior? Apparently none of it arises to like a Harvey Weinstein level or anything like that, but still some pretty obnoxious behavior on the part of this corporate titan in New York, being quite disrespectful and bullying to his employees and so on, based on their gender. And so they all sign. They're all asked to sign these non-disclosure agreements. They get some money in exchange for doing so. And the question came from Elizabeth Warren. I thought it was a great question from her last night. And then Joe Biden and others piled on. But essentially, Mr. Bloomberg, will you release these women from their non-disclosure agreements? Boy, was he on the spot with that. And of course, he demurred. He said no, basically. So yikes.
Yep. It was a very awkward moment. It went on for 2-3 minutes, and then after Elizabeth Warren had her say, it was almost like a little tag team wrestling. She slapped the hand of Joe Biden, not really, but Biden then took over, and he had some tough things to say as well. This, we knew this was going to come up. There is no good answer, I believe, for Bloomberg, but there was a better way to deal with it than he did last night. Would it have solved everything? No, not even close, but the way he handled it last night was almost to just reject it and not understand why there seems to be concern about this.
You know, it actually struck me as a little bit reminiscent of 2016 when Hillary Clinton went and gave those speeches to Goldman Sachs, you know, six-figure speaking fees, and then wouldn't release their contents. And there's this issue of transparency with people who are kind of, you know, in the 1%. Are they willing to disclose stuff to the other 99%? And I think the failure of Mrs. Clinton to do that was really damaging to her campaign. And I think this is a big blow to Bloomberg. It strikes me. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I feel like this is another area where, you know, he's on the inside of a whole list of transactions that nobody else can get in on.
Yeah, I think this potentially is worse for him than the Clinton things with the Wall Street people, because there was no suggestion that she did anything wrong there. Just by the fact that these non-disclosure agreements were signed, there is some tacit understanding that there are maybe not anything wrong, but certainly accusations of wrongdoing involved in this story. So I think this one is actually worse than the Clinton situation 4 years ago that you raised.
You make a really good point. There is that element, that extra element of actual alleged wrongdoing, which was not there in the case of these speeches to Goldman Sachs, unless you just think that anybody who's giving speeches to Goldman Sachs is up to no good. I don't know, but nothing really to base that on ever came out, so who knows. But I wondered also whether you thought that I mean, my sense of Bernie Sanders' performance was he kind of just held his own. He didn't really gain a lot from this, but he also didn't lose anything, and as the front runner,
right,
I guess that's what he wants, right?
Exactly. Now listen, there was the issue of electability when they talk about the socialism, socialist Democrat. That is not good. But listen, that is part of the Bernie Sanders package. So when it's brought up, it's something that you're going to expect. That, I think, was not necessarily good for him in the long run. Short term, don't know if it's going to have much effect. If he comes out of Super Tuesday with a big win, it may be very tough to stop him from getting the nomination.
So Pete Buttigieg is beating up on Amy Klobuchar for not remembering the name of President Lopez Obrador of Mexico in her interview with Telemundo the other day. And then Elizabeth Warren jumps in and comes to the defense of Amy Klobuchar. What did you think of that exchange?
I found it a bit awkward and strange that Pete Buttigieg was getting so incensed that she could not remember the name. It was one of those where, you know, I'm making a decision on my own saying, you know, you can give her a break. It's not like he is as well known as Justin Trudeau or Vladimir Putin. Probably it would be best if she knew his name, but she didn't. And you just sort of move on from there. I was surprised that Pete Buttigieg made such an issue of it. Not saying he was wrong in what he said, but still was surprised he made such an issue about it.
I'll tell you, there's somebody who was posting online the other day a comment along the lines of, you know, to be fair, were all the other candidates asked to and put on the spot what the name of the current president of Mexico was? And I responded to that by just saying, well, if they haven't been asked yet, I bet you they're standing in front of a mirror going, Andres Manuel López Obrador. Andres Manuel López Obrador.
And listen, there are a lot of countries out there, a lot of countries that the U.S. has relations with. Are you going to ask them if they remember the name of some hotbed country where suddenly in the Middle East, do you know the head of state of some small emirates, which can be very important in the oil struggle that we, you know, probably the fight for power and natural resources. So I just did find that a bit of a surprise that that she was really coming under attack from Buttigieg. I was sort of surprised that the questioner from, I believe, Univision was, she seemed to be quite taken back that she didn't know the name of the Mexican president as well.
Yeah.
That's my personal opinion there. But
well,
I don't think that's going to have any impact in November. I don't think they're going to talk about, gee, remember that moment when Klobuchar and Buttigieg, probably not going to have any impact at all.
You know, I actually thought that Buttigieg last night was he was taking a lot of swings at people, and not all of them connected that well. I mean, that was the difference between him, really, I thought, and Elizabeth Warren, who, when she took a swing at somebody, it really seemed to connect.
I thought Buttigieg had some good points, especially going after Sanders. You know, this whole issue of his extreme views compared to the mainstream, the moderates, it's something that needs to be brought up. I think the Democrats feel that way. And at least dealt with. And he was willing to bring it up. And I thought those were good points to bring up. Don't know if it made that much difference. But Bernie Sanders, I do think, needs to raise his voice and, you know, just deal frankly with, do his policies have a potential downside when it comes to a general election in November? Are the, you know, people in the Middle West, you know, flyover country, as we call it, are they going to be comfortable with a man who identifies himself as a socialist? It could be very tough. And I think he also has to be very frank. Is there a vulnerability if Donald Trump wants to use that as an attack tool, using the term socialist, mixing in the word communist once in a while as well?
Yeah.
I think it does. I think Sanders does have some potential vulnerability there. I don't think he wants to address it, but it might be better if he did.
Well, I've been saying on this show for a while that I thought Sanders actually would do well to say that what he's really after is a more ethical capitalism, a more responsible capitalism, a more sustainable capitalism, a more humane, labor-friendly. You apply the adjectives. And then challenge other people, say, so you don't agree with being more ethical or more sustainable? I don't know whether that would.
Steve, it is going to be, if he gets the nomination, believe me, this is going to be Donald Trump's favorite word in the campaign, socialism. He will use that as much as he used the word crooked 4 years ago.
Yeah, crooked Hillary and socialist Bernie or whatever.
Yeah.
Steve Futterman of CBS News, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I always appreciate it.
Great talking to you. I'll give you a bit of a hint. I've been told that it's very possible that Mr. Sanders will be, maybe this is known by everyone in Vermont right now, but very likely he will be in Vermont on Super Tuesday, which is going to be probably a very big night for him. So the celebration for the Sanders campaign, not officially, not 100%, but very likely going to be in Vermont on Super Tuesday.
Good to know. Thank you very much for that. On Thursdays, in our second hour of the Dave Graham Show, we like to run a segment we call Seeds to Society. It is organized with the big help from the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont. We have someone from that college as a guest, typically on many of our Seeds to Society segments. And sure enough, today, Julie Smith's going to be joining us. She is a PhD research associate professor in the UVM Department of Animal and Veterinary Sciences. We're going to be talking about herd health and biosecurity on Vermont's dairy farms. Also joining us is a dairy farmer. From Chester, Vermont, down in the southern part of the state. Lisa Kamen is the founder of the Jersey Girls Dairy, and I'm thinking the Jersey probably refers to the cows on the farm there. So, Lisa and Julie, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Hi, Dave. Glad to be here. This is Julie.
Hi. And Lisa, let me start with you. Are these, in fact, Jersey cows you milk down there in Chester?
Yep. Jersey Girls Dairy is because it relates to everybody. I grew up in New Jersey, so I tell everybody I'm from the state of, and the girls are from the Isle of.
So. Okay, all right, and it's a nice meeting of the minds or something in right there in Chester, Vermont, which is a lovely town. I like Chester a lot. It's a great place.
It is. The people are wonderful here.
Yep. And how many cows do you have there, Lisa?
We milk between 20 and 25 Jerseys.
So it's a small operation, basically, right?
Yep.
And are you doing it organically, or is it a conventional farm?
Well, kind of neither. Kind of do my own thing. Basically, free-range, cow comfort-oriented, rotational intensive grazing, disease-free, closed mm-hmm. herd.
And so you must have some special thoughts and concerns and challenges in your style of farming related to biosecurity. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It's my number one priority is to keep the healthiest herd I can keep so that my product is the healthiest it can be.
And I want to bring in Lisa Julie Smith into the conversation here. Julie, you're one of the things I suspect you do and people in your organization do for sure is to go out and advise farmers on the various techniques of keeping their herds healthy and safe and avoiding any threats to that. What about a small farm that is it sounds like a as Lisa says, she kind of goes her own way here to some extent. What sort of advice do you share with folks like that?
Sure, Dave. Well, the importance of biosecurity is that everyone wants to keep their animals healthy, and it doesn't matter what size the farm is or what kind of animals are on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So biosecurity practices are designed to help prevent the introduction of disease-causing organisms, you know, these microbes, whether they're bacteria or viruses or parasites, and if they happen to be on the farm, to help minimize their spread on the farm.
And are large farms and small farms as susceptible to the same kinds of disease threats, or are there different things that sort of are more of an issue depending on the size of the farm, maybe even the breed of cattle?
Well, it's more related to the species of animal in terms of what types of disease threats we're worried about,
mm-hmm.
And it depends on how the farm is managed. So one of the key ways that diseases can come onto farms is through animal introductions. So farms that have more purchases of animals, or they have animals they're bringing in for breeding purposes, or maybe they're showing animals that are mixing with animals from other farms, it's those introductions or returning animals that pose a greater risk because they can be carrying diseases and parasites with them.
What are some of the key diseases that are most worried about on Vermont's dairy farms?
Well, I can't say from the farmer's perspective what's the disease that they're most worried about right now, but a disease that I have spent a lot of time talking with farmers about, and I'm quite involved with the state program, about controlling a disease called Yoni's disease. And this is a contagious disease. It's a slowly progressing, very chronic disease that affects the intestine of primarily cattle and other ruminant animals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's partly because of this slowly progressing nature of the disease that it's so hard to control, because animals can be infected when they're very young and they don't show signs for 2, 4, maybe 10 years.
Wow, and all of that time, because it's contagious, they could actually be spreading it before it's noticed?
Well, they don't start spreading it right away, but they can start to shed the organism before we know that they are shedding it. So the tests aren't perfect, so it can be, and they can be expensive. So it can be hard to know what the actual status of an individual animal in the herd is.
When you When you go out, do you actually go out and travel around and meet with farmers on their places?
I do. I do it a lot less often than when I was fully with Extension at the university, but I do get out on farms at least once or twice a year, usually related to talking with people about their yonis management.
Wow. And the other health problem I hear about among cows in particular is mastitis. Is that contagious, and does that spread that way, or is that a sort of a very localized thing?
Sure. Well, in terms of cattle diseases, mastitis is probably the most economically important disease that farmers deal with. And there are contagious and non-contagious types of mastitis, and some respond better to antibiotic treatment than others. So it really is important for a farm to understand what types of pathogens they're dealing with in terms of infections.
And Lisa Kamen of the Jersey Girls Farm down in Chester, tell me what diseases keep you up at night? Not personally, but I mean diseases among your cows.
Honestly, none. I've got this place locked down pretty tight with a lot of help from Julie. She's been coming here for way over a decade, possibly going on 2 decades. So, like I said, I have a closed herd. I'm very conscientious about not letting animals mix with outside animals. I don't really have any diseases here. Mastitis is one. You can get, anybody can get mastitis. It doesn't have to be introduced by another animal. It just is a thing.
Yeah.
But we probably have maybe 2 cases of mastitis a year.
Wow, that's a pretty small number. I mean,
and that's a lot. That has a lot to do with animal care and cleanliness and stuff like that.
Right, right. Now, in the case of your lockdown techniques, talk to me a little bit about what some of those are.
It just means I don't go out and buy other animals and bring them in. My animals don't leave the farm and then come back. If I sell an animal, it doesn't come back here.
Okay, and so do you ever feel like there's a downside to that? In other words, let's say you might want to bring in, let's say one of your existing animals, retires from active milking or passes, dies, and you feel like I'd like to replace that animal because I want to keep up my supply of milk.
Yeah, well, like most farms, I raise heifer calves for replacement animals, so.
So it's all, you really do keep it right there on the farm, the whole evolution of your herd, basically.
I really do, because there's lots of stuff out there that you can bring into a herd that you're never going to be able to get out, and I just don't want to take that chance.
And do you, when talking with other farmers, do you find that that's a pretty common approach and attitude about all this, or what's your sense?
Depends on the farm. There are some farms that are more worried about stuff like that than others. Lots of farms do raise their own replacements so that they don't wind up in the position that they have to go bring in animals and not sure what they're going to wind up bringing in. Because a lot of times, like Julie said, you can't tell an animal has something, and the tests aren't perfect, and they're expensive, and it's just a big risk.
Yeah. I suppose if you really feel like you can keep it all locked down, as you, the phrase, your phrase, I guess that sounds like a pretty solid strategy, and I gather it's worked for you for years now.
It does work for me, and like when I go to sell animals, I can tell people, you know, we're certified by the state as the Yonis Free Herd and all that stuff, so if people do want to buy animals from me, they can be pretty certain that they're not going to bring something onto their farm, which is another way to do it, like go to specific farms you know have certifications.
Yeah.
If you need to buy animals, don't just go like to an auction because you have no idea what you're getting there.
Yeah, and I would imagine that that is a fairly risky proposition. The milk you make at the farm there, the Jersey Girls Farm in Chester, where does it end up usually? Where does it go?
I sell a lot of raw milk. I have a very strong customer base for the raw milk, and then I sell to cheese makers. I sell to Woodcock Farm Cheese and Crowley Cheese.
I see. Okay. So you have a good lineup of clients buying your product, basically, it sounds like.
Yep. It's all people that are concerned with the highest quality milk to make their products with. Yes.
Sure. It all makes sense to me. We are fast approaching the bottom of the hour, which means that we go to a one-minute CBS News update. A couple words from our sponsors here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. And I want to continue this conversation with Julie Smith and Lisa Kamen. Julie is with the University of Vermont's Department of Animal and Veterinary Sciences, and Lisa is a farmer in Chester, Jersey Girls Farm. So let's do that. Let's go to a break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes continuing to talk about dairy herd health and biosecurity and those good things. We'll be back shortly, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smart Wool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, and my guests are Julie Smith. She is an animal scientist at the University of Vermont, and Lisa Kamen is the farmer at the Jersey Girls Farm in Chester, Vermont, and we're talking about dairy herd health, biosecurity, how to keep your cows healthy, basically. And Lisa, I was noting that you've been involved in this effort for a number of years, and that there are a lot of discussions nationally and internationally about the whole subject of biosecurity on our farms. One item I read indicated that Australia actually has quite a robust program on this in this field, whereas the U.S. does not as much. What is Australia doing that the United States is not doing, and should the United States get more aggressive?
Well, I don't know a lot about Australia, but they definitely encourage farms to pay attention and care about the biosecurity of their animals. Because there's some diseases that can spread rampantly, and then you're a heck of a time getting it back under control, right?
Yeah.
So the United States, generally food agriculture, I'm pretty disappointed in the United States. But anyway, and Vermont in specifically needs to step it up on helping farms maintain their biosecurity and do the help with the testing and all that.
Well, let me ask about that. What does Vermont need to do? What are the top two or three things that Vermont needs to step it up?
Well, like New Hampshire. New Hampshire, the state goes and tests all its dairy cows. Every dairy animal in the state gets tested for three or four diseases. I think every two, maybe 3 years. I forget the exact amount.
Mm-hmm.
But the state takes care of it. It's not the burden of the farmer.
If the animals test positive, are they put down?
I can't answer that, and I'm guessing it depends on what it is it tested positive for.
Right, okay. I mean, there are some diseases where you pretty much have to do that, and others I suppose that are considered to be perhaps short-lived or whatever. Now, this regular testing that the state of New Hampshire does and Vermont does not, is that an expensive thing, or is that something that is a fairly easily manageable cost?
Most of them are fairly expensive because a lot of them have to be administered by a veterinarian, so there you have the expense of that.
Yeah.
And as you know, dairy is not in a good position to take on any extra expenses these days.
Right.
So it is a struggle.
Yeah, what else aside from testing, are there other techniques or things that are being done in other states or countries where that Vermont could, again, to use your phrase, step up?
Well, there's always ways to step up, but I would say that's a pretty big one, because if you don't know what you have, you can't deal with it, right? And you can't
Well, Dave, another area is one that Lisa and I have been involved in, the Yonis program. There used to be federal and state support to help farmers work with veterinarians to develop plans and to do some testing, mm-hmm. and those funds have gone away, and so that's been a real challenge for continuing some of those programs when then the farmer has to bear those costs.
Yeah, when I got into the program, it was free. It was, the cost did not fall on me, and now I have to pay for it.
And what kind of an annual expense is that for you, Lisa?
Julie, I don't know.
So it's in the range of $200 to $300 for a small herd like Lisa's, and if you have more animals, you need to do more testing, so that gets more expensive in a hurry.
Right, that would add up for sure.
Yeah.
Hey, listeners out there, 244-1777 is the call-in number here for the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And if you have any questions or comments you would like to make, ask or make about dairy herd health, we have a couple of experts on the line right now here on the Dave Graham Show, and it's a great opportunity to get your questions about this realm answered, or make a comment that you would like to be heard by a Vermont dairy farmer, Jersey Girls Farm there in Chester, and or the University of Vermont's Department of Animal Science, and the person of Julie Smith. And now let me ask you, Julie, if I could, do you feel like Vermont is doing everything it can at this point, given budgetary constraints and so on, or are there specific areas where Vermont needs to improve and could be improving, you know, right? Set a goal at the end of the year. We want to get X done by then.
Dave, I think it's hard for a small state, meaning a state with a small population, to fund all of the programs that we really want. And so I think really the emphasis has to be on supporting the educational programs. It would be great to have more extension specialists, more folks who are out in the field providing education, helping farmers assess what their risks are, helping them to assess what steps they could take, what's practical to implement in their situation, what won't cost that much, but could actually have a significant return to them. It's the people providing information and helping farmers make good decisions that aren't selling a product that I think really could help our situation in terms of herd health.
Let's go to some specific steps that farmers need to take. Give us some examples of sort of biosecurity best practices, Julie, if you would.
Sure, and I'm going to start by saying I hope everyone visits our new website. We have a website at healthyagriculture.org that is a hub of resources about biosecurity for all kinds of farmers, whether you've got poultry, beef, dairy, pigs, you name it. We have information specific to different species, and then the main things that people need to be I would say organizing their thinking around when you're talking about biosecurity, and those are the activities around prevention, detection, and response. And so it's the prevention side that we really focus on with biosecurity, because we don't want to be bringing in the problem in the first place. And then there is the aspect of what some people call biocontainment, where, okay, so we know we have a disease. How do we minimize it? How do we keep it from spreading to more animals in the herd? So it depends a little bit on the type of disease that we're dealing with. When we're working with farms on Yonis management plans, we're focused on all of the opportunities for manure contamination to spread, for manure to contaminate feed, for manure to contaminate water, for manure from adult animals to come near young animals, because they're the ones most susceptible to picking up the Yonis disease. So we walk through and look at each area. We look at it from age groups of management and think through, okay, so how clean is this area? How clean's the water? How clean's the feed? Are these animals mixing at any point with older animals? And then walk through, okay, so what can we do to reduce that contamination?
We have a listener on the line. Keith is calling from Brookfield. Good morning, Keith.
Yes, good morning.
What's on your mind?
So just a comment. I own and operate a large dairy farm here in Brookfield, Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we've done is for biosecurity is just to do a really, really good job with all our herd health management activities. And we're what you would call a closed herd. So we're not purchasing in any animals. And we've had, you know, a lot of the diseases that you guys are speaking about, and they've all disappeared just for that simple act.
That sounds like progress to me.
Oh, it's definitely total progress. But anyway, yes. So thank you for that.
Alrighty. Well, I want to congratulate you, Keith, and the entire dairy industry in Vermont to the extent that we are making progress on this stuff. I mean, it's sometimes just a nice thing to. I of course cover a wide range of topics here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, and I when I hear about somebody actually, you know, addressing some issue that was bigger or more of a problem 10 years ago than it is now, I kind of have to pause for a moment and go.
Yeah.
Let's have some gratitude, right?
Yes, I would agree. I believe it's probably less of a, at least for us, or it's much less of a problem than it used to be. There's a lot of good state employees, much like the speakers today, that have helped educate us and continue to deal with any problems that we have, and it's nice to have those guys on our back pockets here.
That's great. Well, that's good to hear. Thank you for the call, Keith. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That must kind of Julie Smith of UVM's Department of Animal Science, Animal and Veterinary Science. That must kind of warm the cockles.
That's great to hear. And the Sprigs have a great farm. They actually hosted breakfast on the farm. Was it just last year, Keith? And it was just really great to let people see what they're doing there.
Yeah, that's a nice thing where you're able to get out and go visit with folks and see what they're up to out there. So talk to me a little bit about the degree to which UVM Extension in particular, but the overall staff there at the university in the agricultural related fields are able to get out there and work, you know, on the farms in Vermont with folks, getting the kind of scientific and other knowledge that out into the people are actually applying it every day with their cows.
I think we're really fortunate here in Vermont, Dave, that farmers are very willing to work with the researchers from campus. And we have a lot of different types of studies that are going on. I've been fortunate in the time that I've worked on biosecurity, both education and some research programs, that we've worked with farms in many parts of the state and asking them lots and lots of questions and getting their insights about different aspects of what makes it hard, what would make it easier, and just getting those insights has been really, really great.
And talk to me a little bit about different animals and their own kind of biosecurity profiles, if you would. Is this a bigger issue for cows than for sheep or goats or vice versa? Or how would you sort of rank the different species that people are keeping in terms of how much they need to spend time and money on thinking about biosecurity?
Right. I think we fool ourselves into thinking that maybe another species doesn't have problems. Each species has different disease issues, and especially for people who are getting into, starting a business with a species that they're not familiar with, it's really important to check in with some veterinarians or some extension folks and find out, so what questions do I need to be asking? Because you want to make sure that you're sourcing animals from herds that either are testing, that they're low risk or don't have some of these key diseases, so that you can make sure you're bringing in the healthiest animals possible. Lisa was really, really fortunate when she started her herd that she brought in really healthy animals. And so she's been able to maintain that. And I can't tell you how rare that is. So it's more often that we have someone who's like Keith, seen that, oh, we have to do something different. We have to close things down and really get on top of managing things. Well, if you don't have them to begin with, your animals just are a whole lot healthier, and it's a whole lot easier to manage them.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Lisa, how long have you had your herd there?
Jersey Girls Dairy turned 20 last October 2nd.
Well, happy 20th, belated happy 20th birthday to the farm.
Thank you.
And where did you get your initial where did you get your cows?
Yep. So when I started my farm, I researched where I was going to buy animals. I knew I wasn't going to an auction or just out there buying animals. I researched where to go. I went and visited the farms. I went and talked to the farmers. I made sure I saw all their testing, all their milk tests and everything, so I wouldn't bring, you know, start out with problems from the get-go, because that's not a good way to start out.
Nope.
So I got most of my beginning herd from a farm called Mollybrook Farm up in Danville, mm-hmm. in Cabot. Really good farm, Jersey herd. And I got some from Springbrook Farm down south here in Redding.
I see. Okay, so all within Vermont, and and brought them down to your farm, got them going, and here you are 20 years and change later.
Yep. Wow.
Time flies when you're milking cows, right?
It sure does.
Talk to me a little bit, if you would, Lisa, about your use of vaccines and kind of how that compares. Is that a bigger and more important tool, or about equal or not as important as this sort of sense of almost quarantine you have for your cows there?
I would say it's pretty equally important. I mean, what's the best way to reintroduce and eradicate a disease in an area, right? Stop vaccinating for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
However, some of these diseases, especially yonies that we've been talking about, there is no vaccine for. So
yeah,
that you have to manage, you know, manage your way out of or whatever. Because if there is no vaccine, that's your only option.
Right, I see. Okay, and with yonies, I mean, is that your biggest worry, or do you also worry about other things as well?
Me personally, I don't really have too many worries because
You were telling me earlier things are cruising along in very good shape there.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of challenges to the cows because we keep them at a minimum on purpose.
Right, right.
But yeah, there's definitely diseases out there that are scary.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody should be worried about their prevention. I think the state of Vermont could do a little bit more to help out. I do sell a lot of raw milk here, so the state law says I have to test my animals for certain diseases.
Yeah.
One of which has TB, which doesn't have a vaccination, but the other one's brucellosis, which does have a vaccination.
Oh, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but what the state has done with its regulation is kind of push farmers into stopping vaccinate for brucellosis because we have to test them whether we vaccinate them or not, and it's really expensive. So farmers are choosing to stop vaccinating to make up for the extra expense of being forced to test.
I see.
That is a bit of a maybe unintentional consequence of a regulation that the state made, that they are now kind of setting up the situation they were trying to prevent.
Yikes. Well,
so anyway.
Hey, we have a listener calling in. Let's go to Fred in Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. I'm thinking within 10 years, vertical truck farming will be cost effective. It would reduce transportation costs. And we could have fresh vegetables year-round.
Vertical truck farming, a little bit off our topic today, but hey, Lisa, actually, let me ask you, in addition to your dairy herd, do you do other kinds of farming down there?
We have a flock of laying hens, yep.
Uh-huh. What about vegetables or that sort of thing?
Nope, don't do that.
No veggies.
Nope.
So, Fred, I think you got to call back when we got a veggie farmer on the show. How's that? Ask about vertical truck farming. All right, there we go. Fred is a frequent caller to the show, and he oftentimes introduces topics I wasn't expecting. But that's just one of the fun bumps in the road about it's like four-wheeling out in the woods or something when you're on live radio sometimes.
Dave, biosecurity does apply to crops, too, so maybe you can add that to a segment.
There's a thought. Elaborate on that a bit. What are the prime biosecurity thoughts about crops, about vegetables,
well,
or other
people growing crops? They have to worry about diseases and pests too, and there's whole organizations around crop protection, right? What do you use, what chemicals, what practices, you know, so they have biosecurity practices around plant production, just like we can for animal production. So biosecurity is really broader than just
livestock. Health. Yeah, actually, that's interesting. I mean, I suppose if you're growing if you're growing some kind of vegetable and you bring in a whole bunch of starters that are infested with some certain kind of pest or whatever that you didn't have on your property before, guess what? You just introduced something you may not have wanted to introduce.
So, that's right.
That would be a concern and something for folks to think about.
And our website right now, healthyagriculture.org, is just focused on animals, but we are hoping that we'll get additional funding so we can extend that out to the whole crop and plant side of agricultural operations as well.
You know, and it's really, I think it's a good thing for farmers to think about, and for others who obviously eat the produce and the meat and the dairy products and so on from farms, to think about from time to time just how well are we doing in terms of managing our farms, the health of the crops and the animals we're growing on our farms. I mean, it's got to be a big concern, not just economically for farmers, but for the overall food supply.
Exactly, and we're expecting a pretty small percentage of the population to grow all the food. So the more we can convince people that helping those farmers implement good biosecurity, the better off everyone will be.
All right. Well, I think, I actually think that that's a good note on which to end our discussion today. And Julie Smith of the University of Vermont's Department of Animal and Veterinary Sciences, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good to be here.
And Lisa Kamen of the Jersey Girls Farm in Chester, also I've enjoyed talking with you, and I wish you luck and disease-free dairy farming for long into the future.
Thank you. That's the goal.
Yep, already. Well, thank you so much. We are fast approaching the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show. I just wanted to mention a couple things. One is that tomorrow morning on the Dave Graham Show, we will be broadcasting live from the Vermont State House over in Montpelier, catching up with some of our legislators about what's been going on under the Golden Dome. And I also wanted to mention our podcast. Don't forget, if you wanted to hear this entire segment, you just tuned in the last 10 minutes and said, oh, shucks, I missed the earlier part, you can always go to our podcast, WDEVradio.com is the webpage for the station. Follow the link from that homepage to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit. You'll usually find our segments by topic and or guests, and you can figure out what you want to listen to. Put your dance card together from that. So that's a good. And we thank the Warren Store, the friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store for their support of our podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. Stay tuned now for Bill Sarah, Common Sense Radio, and have a great day.